I'm Ann Boylan. I'm now an emerita professor of history and women and gender studies at the University of Delaware.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you became interested in researching women's rights.
Okay, that's a long story, but I attended a women's college. When I came out of graduate school, my first teaching job was teaching women's history. That was in the early 1970s. I got my PhD in 1973. And there was a great deal of demand among students for courses in women's history because it was during the women's movement, the last phase. And so I became, I loved teaching the course, became very interested in it. When you teach the history of women, you have to teach the history of women's rights. It isn't all of it, but it's an important part of it. And then about 10 years ago, I got asked to write a documents textbook type of book for college classrooms by Oxford University Press, and the focus they wanted was not women's history in general, but women's rights.
You had mentioned earlier a few pages on Delaware women.
Yeah, right.
Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, I gave a talk in the library, and the library had a little book signing, and somebody bought the book, and then he came up to me afterwards, and he said, "I looked up Delaware in your index, and there are only two entries." So I said, well, you know, Delaware's important, but... So the two entries that I got for Delaware both came from the Delaware Historical Society. One is a memoir written by a woman named Mary Wilson Thompson. Mary Wilson Thompson and Emily Pusey Warner would have been on totally opposite sides of the suffrage issue. Mrs. Warner absolutely helped to lead the Delaware coalition to get women's suffrage ratified by the state. Mrs. Thompson, determined to be opposed to women's suffrage, she and Emily Bissell, who is for whom the hospital up in Newport is named, were opposed to women's suffrage. And they led the Delaware Association opposed to the extension of suffrage to women. And in 1920, when the 19th Amendment was in the process of being ratified, and the ratification process was going along, and Emily Pusey Warner and Mabel Vernon and Florence Byard Hillis, other Delaware suffragists, they thought Delaware should help put this over the top. Delaware should be one of the states to ratify the 19th Amendment. So they got the governor to call a special session of the assembly. They went down to Dover, and they were met by the antis, including Mary Wilson Thompson. And the antis won. They managed to get the legislature to refuse to ratify the amendment. And later on, this is the document in the book, Mrs. Thompson has a memoir, and she writes in the 1930s, "I've always opposed suffrage for women. I don't think women need the right to vote. Women should take care of their men. And besides, all these young women today going around in their short skirts and smoking their cigarettes are no good example for anybody of being involved in civic rights." It's such a funny piece, and I thought, I have to put this in the book, because it's like 15 years after women have won the right to vote, and she still thinks that women should not be voting. And then the other document is actually a visual, and it's a page from the Wilmington Every Evening newspaper from 1960. It's a help wanted ad, and it's very clear. At the top it says, "Help wanted male, help wanted female," because that was legal until 1969 to advertise different jobs for women and men. And I found this one particularly interesting because it would say something like, "Cook wanted white." And that was legal. You could advertise for a white woman to do your cooking. Or on the men's column, it could say barber colored. So I thought that made a really great point visually for anybody using it to see. This was a newspaper, and this was quite legal to advertise on the basis of race and gender.
In your research, where does Delaware fit in the national and international picture in terms of the women's rights movement?
Well, Delaware women were very visible and active in the two main suffrage organizations, especially by the time of the turn of the century and up to 1920. So there are two of these organizations. They split off around 1916. One is the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which was what Emily Pusey Warner was involved with, and the other was the National Woman's Party, headed up by Alice Paul, who was from New Jersey. And Lucy Burns, and people would be familiar with that group because they were the focus of a feature film a few years ago called Iron-Jawed Angels. They were more militant, And they thought that you shouldn't just go lobby Congress, you should be right in Congress's face. So they picketed the White House. They got themselves arrested for disturbing the peace. Not because they were disturbing the peace, because men would come to see them picketing, and they would yell at them and say things to them. They paraded down Pennsylvania Avenue, and eventually chained themselves to the White House fence. They got arrested. They got sent to the Occoquan Workhouse in Virginia. They went on hunger strikes. They were force-fed. I mean, this is really very much in your face, calling attention to the issue, which is different from Mrs. Warner's group and their approach. Delawareans who were involved in the National Woman's Party included Mabel Vernon, very, very well-known name, and Florence Byard Hillis, who came from a very distinguished Delaware family, the Byards.
And tell me more about Mrs. Warner and kind of her role in the Women's College.
Yeah, well, now, Emma P.C. Warner was, from what I understand, always regretted that she never had a college education herself because she came from that generation, or maybe opportunity wasn't available. So education was an important priority for her, and she was involved in promoting public education in Delaware in general. Delaware was kind of slow to adopt, for example, compulsory schooling laws and that kind of thing. And then she was very active in the formation of women's clubs. Founding women's clubs, as they were called, really was something that began in the 1880s. The Wilmington New Century Club, which is now, their clubhouse is still on Delaware Avenue in Wilmington, and it's the home of the Children's Theater. Okay. So there, that organization was one that she was very heavily involved in. And women's clubs, women's organizations, the Women's Christian Temperance Union in Wilmington, these were all groups that came together to promote women's suffrage. So Mrs. Warner's interest in education, in women's college, in women's clubs, I think, led her in these directions. And so she spent a lot of time saying that Delaware needed a women's college.
And you mentioned Title IX, yes. And how does Delaware play into that?
Well, Title IX, 1972, part of the Education Amendments, was really spectacularly important for women students at UD, initially at least, when it came to athletic scholarships. That was one of the first ways it was applied. Because Title IX said that states, that schools that took federal money could not discriminate on the basis of sex. And it was athletic programs that saw the first impact. So when I first started teaching in 1973, there were very few female athletes who had scholarships. I think that has been a huge, huge change. And you can see it if you see charts on women going to college, and playing sports in college. The other area in which Title IX nowadays has had a big impact is on sexual assault and sexual harassment on campus. That's a relatively new interpretation. Sexual harassment was not considered to be illegal under the 1964 Civil Rights Act until 1986, a famous Supreme Court case, Meritor Bank versus Michelle Vinson. But in recent years, legal plaintiffs have begun to use Title IX to address the problem of sexual assault and sexual harassment on campus. So one thing I've noticed in the years that I've been here is that the Title IX emphasis has shifted much more now toward enforcement of laws on sexual assault and sexual harassment. Wow. And then Title IX also had an impact, I think we were talking about this earlier, in getting some of the very elite all-male schools to admit women, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia. They all went co-ed in the 1970s, and I think Columbia was the last one, 1980. But until that time, a girl who wanted an education that was considered to be as good as going to Harvard or Yale would have to go to a comparable women's college, like Radcliffe or Smith, Bryn Mawr, Mount Holyoke, which was founded in the 1830s. And it also had an impact in integrating the gender integrating. The military academies.
You're writing a new book now, right? And tell me a little bit about that.
I have a book project that's kind of underway. It's been underway for a while. I put it aside to finish the women's rights book, but I'm very interested in the ways in which we remember or don't remember women in history. And this controversy that's been really recently just settled about women on currency. the announcement by Secretary of the Treasury Jacob Lew that we will have Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill in 2020. That's the kind of thing that interests me, because I was appalled beyond belief when major political candidates running for the presidential nomination were asked, who would you put on the currency? And they couldn't think of one historical female figure. So they said, my mother. Well, you can't put a living person on the currency. The person has to be dead. So this whole thing started with a young girl writing to the president and saying, why aren't there women on our currency? We did have the Susan B. Anthony dollar and the Sacagawea dollar, but those were kind of a bust because they were too hard to distinguish between them and the quarter.